It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up later, we'll talk about the lore and legend of one of Wisconsin's favorite cocktails, the Bloody Mary.
First, on Friday, the Trump administration announced that it would not release White House visitor logs to the public. Officials cited national security and privacy, but some critics remain unconvinced.
Alex Howard joins us now to discuss the decision and where it fits in with the policies of previous administrations. He's deputy director of the Sunlight Foundation. That's a national, nonpartisan, nonprofit organization that uses technology, open data, policy analysis, and journalism to promote government accountability and transparency. Alex, thanks for joining us today.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
So what exactly did we hear from the Trump administration on Friday?
Well, we heard through the media a fair bit. Today was the first time we actually saw White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer stand before the public and defend this decision. But the essential news here is that the White House is reversing a policy that the Obama administration advanced, which is to publish the visitor logs that the Secret Service collects for visitors of the White House here at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue in Washington, D.C. The Obama White House disclosed nearly 6 million of these records over the course of its two terms and published them at open.whitehouse.gov. Those records remain available to the public, albeit in somewhat less accessible form, at the National Archives archive of the Obama White House.
And had the Trump administration been releasing these visitor logs up until now in this early part of the administration, or have these been in limbo?
No, they had not. This is a decision that people had been awaiting. The Trump administration surprised some people by having a section of the new White House website that was refreshed at noon on Inauguration Day back in January that included under disclosures visitor logs with a promise of transparency to come. Visitors were told that if they checked back, these things would be released soon. And unfortunately, that section of the website is gone, as is the promise of transparency on it.
Before we dig more into the details, why does the public care? Why should we be concerned about whether or not we know who's going through the door at the White House?
Well, this is the people's house, as they say, although often the House of Representatives takes that title too. And these visitor logs are a meaningful, if flawed, record of influence and who is coming to talk to the White House at what time and whom. And over the past 8 years, these logs were used by members of the public and certainly by the media to understand where and how influence was being shaped in Washington and by whom. And that includes reporting upon the health care deliberations back in 2009 and 10. If you recall, that certainly occupied a lot of national attention. And all the lobbying since then by industrial and post-industrial interests. This is a picture of who is coming to talk to the administration. And indeed, if you look for me in there, you'll find me too. I was coming off and as a reporter, as a journalist, and then as an open government advocate to try to understand what's happening. And I think the form that they took in terms of an easily searchable online database that was free to use, reuse, download, and analyze enabled journalists like you to inform the public about patterns and timing, which gave people a picture when combined with the rest of the reporting that journalists or journalistic organizations do of what was happening in D.C. and indeed with whom.
We're talking to Alex Howard from the Sunlight Foundation, looking at the announcement from the Trump administration that they would not be releasing the visitor logs, who comes in and out of the White House to visit the president. You mentioned this was something done under the Obama administration. Was that new, or is this something that previous administrations had done, making this information available and accessible?
This was new. Unlike, say, the president's tax returns, which is a tradition of disclosure that goes back for decades, the publication of White House visitor logs online was a precedent. It was the first time that an administration had done something like this. And taking back the practice, which was a discretionary practice, is indeed a rollback of a transparency measure. There is certainly a lot of nuance here. These were not all of the visitors to the White House. The Obama administration carved out personal visitors, visitors to play with the Obama children, for instance, or to attend a birthday party. Other visitors, such as potential Supreme Court nominees or other people whose names appearing in public, were also carved out. But these exemptions were actually made clear later on as well. It was, I think, the use of a security mechanism, that is the vetting the White House does, as a transparency mechanism. And as such, it was not a perfect system for disclosure of influence, but it was certainly greater than zero, which is what had existed prior.
If these aren't disclosed in this way now, does that mean we're never going to see these logs, or is this something that becomes available later?
It will be something that becomes available later. The Trump administration indicated that, unlike other laws, the FOIA will become relevant to the Secret Service, which is the agency that collects these, 5 years after the end of the Trump administration, whenever that happens to be, as with other presidential records, which is what the administration is arguing these are, and indeed a legal ruling by a D.C. Circuit Court, federal court, by a fellow named Judge Merrick Garland, who your listeners probably know, designated these records as such as presidential records. And that is indeed the ruling that the White House is citing. So in theory, we should have a flawed but meaningful picture into influence that is happening right now, perhaps 9 years from now.
So useful to historians, but not to people looking to track things in real time.
Certainly not to journalists who are writing the second day story, no.
The Trump administration has cited, among other things, national security concerns in announcing this decision, saying, hey, there are people who could use this information in harmful ways, potentially. What do you make of that?
I make of that much the same as you do the claim that we heard again that the president's tax returns could not be released because they're under audit. Just in the same way as the IRS has said that no, that is in fact not the case, we would also debunk this and say that if that is the case, why has there not been evidence of privacy or security harms by the release of nearly 6 million logs over the last 8 years? Certainly, we are always open to the possibility of potential harms and risks to privacy, to national security. But if those existed, we would have expected, A, the Obama White House to have carved out those particular names, and indeed they did have some exemptions, and B, the vast majority of people do not have that set of concerns, and indeed the amount of personally identifiable information that is disclosed online is fairly limited. We're talking about a name, a date, and the person that person is visiting. As someone who's actually submitted this data, I can tell you that the most sensitive part, your social security number and your address, is not amongst that which is disclosed. So we judge that claim to be false.
Looking at wider issues of transparency, looking back at the Obama administration, first of all, President Obama came in saying, we're going to be really transparent. We're going to do a lot to advance transparency. Apart from this disclosure of visitor logs, big picture, how did the Obama administration do on that vow for transparency?
We judge the administration to have had a mixed record on open government. Certainly, there are many different areas where the affirmative, I think, push towards more open government transparency had an impact. The one that we most commonly see news organizations and the public measure them on is the compliance of the Freedom of Information Act, which is indeed something that is a core open government, I think, statute. But there are lots of other sunshine laws, too, and I think by and large they complied with it. We know we hosted a panel during Sunshine Week when I put this question of transparency to some of the nation's top open government advocates from the National Security Archive, from the Project on Government Oversight, from the American Society of News Editors, and they all grudgingly gave the administration a lot of credit for their affirmative agenda. Going beyond FOIA, the very important critique of the use of the Espionage Act to prosecute whistleblowers, the secret surveilling of journalists, the issues around access in the White House, we saw and continue to see a huge amounts of data being published online for public use. We saw a fairly standard amount of press conferences, and it should be said, an affirmation of the role of the press in our democracy, which stands in stark contrast to the current administration. We did see some significant hindrances to public access and journalistic advocates, access to government scientists. Some of that was improved, some not so much. We saw improvements in open access to scientific research online. We did not see significant support for some of the open government reforms moving through Congress, efforts to standardize federal spending data or the Freedom of Information Act. We saw sort of a split screen on whistleblowers, so aforementioned prosecution coupled with the president signing the Whistleblower Protection Act and indeed some additional executive action to strengthen that, with the exception of carve-outs for national security contractors like Mr. Snowden. We did see support for press freedom abroad. Obviously, there was some considerable furor about press freedom more locally. And we saw a, I think, fairly robust development of federal government communication and the architecture of participation and disclosure developed, whereby the administration was the first and platform after platform to adopt it for the use of communicating to the American public, with the American public, and at its best, solving things with the American public around so-called open innovation or citizen science initiatives. You know, this administration, while not the first to use the internet or social media, was certainly the one that matured within that context. And we're still seeing if this new administration is willing and able to go beyond simply using social media for campaigning and to use it for governing and for public information and to use the public itself as a resource in the same way. We see a lot of civil servants continuing those policies, but we've talked with those same civil servants and heard fairly concerning feedback regarding the administration's directives not to talk to the public, and indeed we saw secret gag orders come out at the beginning of this administration.
And Alex, briefly, as we're just about out of time, as we wrap up with an issue like the White House visitor log, what recourse is there for an organization like yours?
Well, we believe in representative democracy with all of its flaws, and we look to Congress to mandate that which the executive branch does not wish to. That's how our government's supposed to work. We need our oversight committee, judicial committee, to do oversight into conflicts of interest. And when you see a democratic norm be bucked, like the disclosure of tax returns, you do what we do and call upon Congress to mandate disclosure. When you see something like visitor logs be adopted as a norm, have value in terms of informing the public, and then be rolled back, we call on Congress to support the enactment of that within statute, and indeed we've done exactly that. Now, this is not something that we've seen appetite for in this current Congress, but we believe that the same Republican leadership that stood up for open government underneath the Obama administration will come around to the idea that it is, in fact, a very good idea when its own party controls the White House.
We'll leave it there for now. Alex, thanks for joining us today.
It was such a pleasure. Thank you.
That's Alex Howard with the Sunlight Foundation. He joined us to discuss the Trump administration's announcement that it will not make public the White House visitor logs. When it comes to the quintessential Wisconsin cocktail, the brandy old-fashioned sure gets a lot of love in these parts, but there's one other drink that's not too far behind, the good old Bloody Mary. The classic combination of tomato juice, vodka, and a slew of garnishes is a staple at Wisconsin bars and restaurants, and no one really bats an eye at you when you order one at 10 o'clock in the morning.
Our next guest is a connoisseur of the cocktail, and he's written a book that both explores the history of the unusually themed drink and shares some recipes, too. Brian Bartles joins us now. He's a managing partner and bar director for Happy Cooking Hospitality in New York City, which operates a handful of restaurants there. He's a born and raised Wisconsinite and author of the new book, The Bloody Mary, The Lore and Legend of a Classic Cocktail, with recipes from brunch and beyond. Brian, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. How are you doing?
Doing well, thanks. Well, you start your book with a confession from Brian Bartles, the early years. You say you weren't always on board. You were skeptical of the Bloody Mary. How come?
Very much so. Well, the Bloody Mary was the first cocktail I learned how to make when I was just learning to be a bartender. So the mechanics were also something I had to basically administer in the moment of a busy brunch, which can always get the best of us. So that being said, it just was a mountain that I needed to climb, and when I eventually climbed it, I wanted to keep growing and keep evolving. And the Bloody Mary is a great cocktail to kind of use as that example of, I think, a platform you can always expand from and also use as your own creative impulses merit. So it's just something that I've always felt like was a challenge for me at first. I didn't love tomato juice in my 20s, and then I just kind of evolved with my palate. And so by the time I reached my 30s, it became a little more user-friendly for me.
And you say the Bloody Mary has kind of this unique property of being a cocktail that brings people together. It sort of creates its own community around the drink. How does that work?
Well, I feel like it's the first cocktail of the day in terms of the social fabric that it warrants. It's something that you want to share with other people. It's about that resurgence of, I think, you know, conviviality and spirit, communal spirit for that matter, and you can definitely get an opportunity to savor, I think, memories or experiences around a community with that cocktail more than anything else. It reminds you of maybe what transpired the day before, but also what you're looking forward to in the day ahead, and I think it's the greatest kind of, you know, barometer for that social construct, which always made it kind of a cocktail that I think even if you didn't drink it, you were always around it. And I think that's a unique way of looking at it in terms of a social dynamic.
Well, you've been making this drink for a long time, long enough to put your own stamp on it and in lots of different ways. So before we go too much farther, let's find out what is in the basic Bloody Mary.
It usually varies between 6 or 7 ingredients, but I feel like it now the contemporary version is associated with 7 ingredients. And the first would be the spirit base, which is vodka. And then also, the next thing you think about is tomato juice. So those two ingredients definitely warrant their own place in its in the annals of Bloody Mary history. But also there's lemon and Worcestershire, as well as black pepper, salt, and then, or celery salt for some, and then Tabasco, or spice of some sort, which makes the 7th.
And we'll get into a little bit about your preference for exactly how this thing is put together, but first I want to talk about the history aspect a little bit, because it's got a bit of a mystery behind it. Do we know exactly where that very first Bloody Mary came from?
Boy, that's a whole nother segment to actually unearth. I lean towards always giving it an association, and the book reflects this, but two people that are directly responsible for always getting the most publication and traction for the history of it. One is George Jessel, who was a vaudevillian entertainer, comedian, claims that he created it loosely after an all-night bender at 8 o'clock in the morning in 1927 in Florida, and that was always like a subject of a little skepticism. And the bartender, the true bartender that gets a lot of credit for it, is a French bartender by the name of Fernand Petieu, and in 1934 he took over the St. Regis King Cole Bar in New York and brought ostensibly this recipe of tomato juice and vodka with him over from Paris, and really took the recipe to new heights in the late 30s at the King Cole Bar at St. Regis, and in the early 40s it saw its first publication, but it was called the Red Snapper. It wasn't even called the Bloody Mary. Due to the owner of the St. Regis, of the Astor family, actually thought that was an offensive, derogatory name, and possibly it was because his second wife was named Mary. That was never established. But ultimately, an article was published in 1964 in the New Yorker where Fernand Petieu claims that George Jessel started the drink, and then he ultimately took the extensions of it, the extra ingredients, to a new level by basically adding the cayenne pepper that he put in there and adding a little bit more of a seasoning. So George Jessel kind of started something, and then Fernand Pettiu took it out onto the highway, as I've always liked to say.
We're talking right now with Brian Bartels about his new book. It's called The Bloody Mary. It's a cultural history of the Bloody Mary, but it's packed full of recipes, too. And, Brian, part of the beauty of the Bloody Mary is that it's kind of this blank canvas at this point. You can put your own spin on it. In fact, you suggest that that's what a really good bartender will do. They'll make it their own. And you shared one recipe with us. We've got it up on the Central Time Facebook page. It's called the Smoked Bloody Bull. Can you tell us about that one?
Yeah. Dale DeGroff, who's pretty much one of the godfathers of modern mixology and cocktails, was a very, still is, an extremely legendary bartender and spirits advisor. He was one of the more popular bartenders in New York in the 80s and worked at some really terrific establishments. When people were kind of not taking cocktails as seriously in the 80s, Dale was the one who was pushing the boundaries and still maintaining a lot of inspiration from what they were doing at the early turn of the century. And Dale created this spin-off of a Bloody Mary by using beef bouillon as beef stock, basically, which kind of made sense.
Wow.
In a creative way, that saltiness that you can get from beef stock, and added that with tomato juice along with some vodka as a spin-off of a classic Bloody Mary, and it took off. It was definitely a popular drink. He bartended at the Rainbow Room in the 80s, and a legendary restaurateur named Joe Baum was kind of always asking him to push the envelope, so to speak, and be creative with his inspirations. And Dale was pretty much established himself overnight as being one of the more, you know, go-to, modern-day legends of creating drinks and cocktails, not just Bloody Mary variations, but many, many new cocktails that are now standards.
And, Brian, we just have a couple of seconds left, but I want to ask you, have we hit peak Bloody Mary? Sounds like people are putting, from what I hear, things like burgers, slices of pizza, chicken wings into their drinks,
yep,
sometimes all at once.
No way. There's no peak. In fact, it's a wide open valley that anybody can explore. It really is. It's something that people should just, like, keep on pushing the envelope and seeing what they can come up with. With the dawn of Instagram, everybody wants to take a photo of something that's so aesthetically pleasing. It's there for everybody, and creativity is boundless.
It's a lot of fun talking to you, Brian. Thanks a lot.
Thank you so much.
That was Brian Bartels, author of The Bloody Mary, The Lore and Legend of a Cocktail Classic, with recipes from brunch and beyond. And you can find the recipe for that Smoked Bloody Bull on the Central Time Facebook page.
We probably tend to think of ourselves as honest people, but there are times when an innocent white lie may not seem like such a big deal.
But new research shows that those little white lies add up, and after a while, it gets easier and easier to be dishonest.
And part of that slippery slope happens because of the way our brains are wired. Regan Gurung is with us now to help sort out all these connections and what they mean. He's the Ben J. and Joyce Rosenberg Professor of Human Development and Psychology at UW Green Bay. He joined us now from the WPR studios in Green Bay. Regan, good to have you back.
Thanks, Rob.
Well, before we get into the research, is it safe to say that most of us want to think of ourselves as honest, moral people?
Absolutely. I think unless you are a sociopath and you don't realize it otherwise, we see ourselves as law-abiding, moral people. And I think morality is one of those big things that many of us believe is what makes us human.
But then you get into the territory of these little white lies, and that's kind of the ambiguous, the gray area where, you know, sometimes it might seem kinder to tell a lie or to do something that's to lie, maybe in a situation where it's easier and it doesn't seem like a big deal. So how do you sort of sort out that kind of dishonesty when you're looking at big picture morality?
And I think here it's a question of the various interactions between the ways human beings think and act and believe and behave. When you think about any act, it's a combination of our thought processes, it's a combination of our feelings, it's a combination of our physiology. And I think some of this new work really nicely shows how all of this goes together. So when you think about the development of morality, for the longest time, psychologists would talk about moral development. You know, Lawrence Kohlberg did these studies where he showed, gave people scenarios and basically asked them, is what happened in the scenario right or wrong? And if so, why? And you could see people at different points of the lifespan have different reasonings for why something was right or wrong. And so once upon a time, we said, okay, so there's this moral development. And if you're not at the right stage of moral development, and this could be chronological, but it's not just age, you have some adults who may not have reached higher levels of moral development. But it's more than that. It's not just this cognitive process. It's also feelings. It's also how our body reacts. And I think that's probably one of the most exciting things. As our sense of measuring our brain gets better, we can see the kinds of things that are going on at a neuronal level that we really couldn't see before. And that's giving us some great insight into the interactions between the various factors that influence morality.
Right. That sounds like it's the key. You mentioned the physiology. It's not just that we think it through and weigh the philosophical implications of being dishonest or doing something immoral. We actually, at least at first, when we do something bad or tell that lie, our brains, it sounds like, feel bad. They send us a jolt of bad feeling. Is that right?
And, you know, that in a sense, yes. And I think, and the reason I say in a sense is for so long we think about the brain versus the mind versus the body. And the reality is it's all one. It's all this one cohesive bit of interactive action. So in a way, and it's all happening so quickly, it's really difficult to, you know, point those directions as to what's coming first. And actually in the emotion literature over the years, that was one of the big debates. What happened first? Do you see a bear and, you know, think you're scared and then scared? Or is it you see a bear, your heart is beating, and you go, oh, my heart's beating, I must be scared. And that actually is one of the predominant theories of emotion, is we actually get feedback from our physiology. So before even, you know, going to the point of our brain is firing in a certain way, making us think a certain way, it's even at the level of, ooh, you know, my heart's beating, why am I physiologically aroused? And then we look around for a label. And that's actually one of the most commonly used theories of emotion is this so-called two-factor theory of emotion that says it's this, we have physiological arousal, and then we look for a label for why we are physiologically aroused. And of course, as you can guess, that leads to some fascinating tweaking and studying where you can actually make somebody think they feel something different, even though, you know, it's got nothing to do with what they're actually feeling. So we can talk about that if that comes up. But that's exactly it. It's this interaction between your physiology. It's our thinking, the thinking part of the brain, trying to make sense of it, putting a label on it, and then acting. So to go back to something Veronica said, you know, especially the little lies, there are some little things. There are some little immoralities that we may not think twice about because you think about it so quickly, there's not enough time for there to be any physiological reaction to guide us into going, should we do it or not? Other things, when we really feel uncomfortable, when we feel guilty, that's when it can really influence the judgment and decision-making process. So I think the more time we give ourselves to really see how we feel, both physiologically, both emotionally, I think, you know, the things, our decisions about whether to do something or not can be very different.
We're talking with Regan Gurung right now, the Ben J. and Joyce Rosenberg Professor of Human Development and Psychology at the University of Wisconsin-Green Bay, talking about new research that shows being dishonest gets easier the more we do it. And let's talk about that getting easier part of it, Regan. So let's say I'm about to tell a lie. I tell someone I like their sweater or their haircut, but really I think it's... Sorry, Rob. It's cat's out of the bag. What really I think is kind of hideous, but I decide to do this, and maybe my heart pounds a little bit. Maybe I get a little flushed in the face. But then the next time I run into that same situation and I have to tell that little bit of a lie, it seems like my body doesn't respond quite as strongly, that it's not as big a deal. So it starts to seem like, you know, it's just a slippery slope here.
Exactly.
At some point, maybe it gets kind of easy to tell that lie.
And I think so. Here, there are two different processes taking place. So you already mentioned, and let me tell you, I've had my fair share of sweater comments. But there's this physiological arousal, and then that the next time, if it's exactly the same situation, our body almost habituates to it. And, I mean, we're all familiar with habituation, even if we don't use that jargony kind of term. But, you know, when you step into your own kitchen for, and you hear once upon a time, you probably heard the sound of the fridge. Or you step here on campus, there are some classrooms where you step in and you can hear the lights buzzing. And you think, oh, how am I going to concentrate? Those lights are buzzing. But you know what? Our brain tunes it out, right? So the next time you step into the classroom or that kitchen, you no longer hear that fridge. You no longer hear the buzzing of the lights. It's the same thing with a startle response. You know, we can really scare somebody by jumping out at them and scaring them or with showing them this scary picture. But if we show them exactly the same picture again and again and again, well, they're not going to be scared anymore. Their brain has habituated to it. That's the same idea that was tested in a recent study where they found that as participants lied, the more they lied, that physiological arousal actually decreased over time. So not only, and you know, I've talked about the beating of the heart before, so not only did the heart rate no longer go up, but in this particular study, they said, let's go beyond heart rate. Let's actually look at the firing of the brain. And they focused on a part of the brain that's been tied to emotions, the amygdala. And I say tied, but I should also want to say that it is now way too simplistic to think that all emotion is just this one part of the brain. Our brains, emotion is all over there. But there is definitely one part that tends to be active more often with certain emotions like fear. And they popped people into an fMRI machine, a functional magnetic resonance imagery machine, and actually looked at their brain functioning while they did a certain task. And the task was sort of interesting too, right? So here's what happens. There's this person in the fMRI machine. There's somebody outside. Now, the person in the machine thinks that both they and the person outside are both part of the study. But aha, that's not the case. The person outside is actually a confederate, is actually an actor, somebody who's been paid by the experimenter to pretend that they're in the study. Now, the person in the fMRI machine has to make judgments about how many coins are in a certain jar and send this judgment by a keyboard to the person on the outside. Now, the way the study is set up is if this person lies about the number of coins in that jar, they benefit, right? So the incentives are pretty clear. They benefit. And what they found over many different trials or doing this many different times is that, sure, the first time when that person lies a little bit, and the first time they actually don't lie too much. They lie a little bit and there's some brain activity. But in succeeding trials, as they do it more, and more and more, not only do they start lying more, but that brain activity actually isn't happening at the same level as it did earlier on. So literally what you see, and they showed this, is over successive trials, the amount of activation of the amygdala actually dropped off. It was almost like the brain was habituating to it. So that brain physiology wasn't happening at the same level, and correspondingly, the amount of lying went up.
We're talking with Regan Gurung right now, professor of human development and psychology at the University of Wisconsin-Green Bay, talking about new research that shows that being dishonest gets a lot easier the more we do it.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think of yourself as an honest, moral person? Do you feel uncomfortable in a situation where you might tell that polite lie? Is it a slippery slope, in fact? And do you have questions about how our brains and our bodies work when it comes to dealing with emotions and dealing with moral issues? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're continuing our conversation now with social psychologist Regan Gurung, talking about why it gets easier to be dishonest the more we do it.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Do you see this in your life? Have you had an experience in your daily life, maybe in your career, where you know, there was some benefit to a little dishonesty, maybe a moral shortcut, and then it got easier and easier to do? Or do you have a question for Regan about how this all works? Call in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll take our first caller now. We have Tim joining us in Eau Claire. Tim, hi.
A couple quick questions for you. Mm-hmm. One, I'm wondering how this would deal with poker players who effectively, that is kind of their job to hide whether they're lying or not. Second, you guys use the term morality. I've always learned that morality is an individual precept. So for one person, it might be more okay to lie or something to that effect. And then one last quick follow-up question that just popped into my head. Can you train someone the other way? So take a child who has been conditioned to lie and recondition them not to lie.
Yeah, I was wondering about that last one, too. Thanks, Tim. Lots of interesting questions. Let's start with the poker players, Regan. So what does this tell us about poker players? Nothing good? Or is there something here we're missing, a nuance?
Well, I think the bottom line here, and actually Tim has three great points that sort of all go together in some ways. But the first one is for poker players or anybody who is in these situations and needs to for a living, and that's a whole separate story as who needs to, but it's practice. It's practice. Because of the study we talked about that clearly shows that it is habituation, as long as you practice it, namely do it over and over, you get better at it. So you can tell a novice poker player from somebody who's been doing it for a really long time because they've got practice doing it. And I think human beings are very good at adjusting their physiology once they pay attention to it. So just like you can fool a lie detector, you can actually practice and get much, much better. And I think, quite honestly, the sad reality is for a lot of people who seem to make a living out of being dishonest or are dishonest pretty often, they've done it so often that they can now do it without feeling any of that. Let's hit the other one. The morality as an individual level, this actually ties to a bigger point, which is morality really varies with culture pretty significantly. So there are culture broadly defined, whether it's geographic, whether it's race, ethnicity. There are different prescriptions for what is right and wrong in different cultures. And then you can also bring that to the individual level where based on their learning, based on their households, based on how their family treated them, what their parents did, their sense of right or wrong may be very different. So you can have, 10 people in a room and because of different experiences growing up, their sense of right or wrong will be different. So Tim's right on there where to some extent morality does have a lot of individual variance. But when we pull the camera back, as it were, you can see some clear-cut cultural similarities as well. So, that's always factors in. I think Tim also used a really important word here. That's the conditioning. I think we get both conditioned to be moral, and we can likewise use conditioning, as it were, to be to change immoral behaviors. And here, by conditioning, I'm referring to the more classical, psychological science of, reward and punishment. You can punish people for being immoral and it'll quickly extinguish that behavior. And by the same token, you can use incentives and reward good behavior, which in the big scheme of things, reward is always the better way to go.
Thanks for the call, Tim. We'll go next to Jay in Appleton. Jay, hi.
Hi. Interesting topic. I appreciate it.
What do you want to bring up, Jay?
Well, on the line of children again, can you condition your children inadvertently to easily lie? So if they do, small things when they're little that you don't make a big deal out of, right? They become accustomed to desensitizing, in essence, the guilt that they should feel.
Interesting, Jay. Thanks a lot for the call. Regan, can we maybe even accidentally be training our kids to be better and better and more remorseless liars?
Absolutely. And I think the bad news is when we think about conditioning, we often think about, are you rewarded or punished for doing something? And actually, one of the most famous studies in psychology involves a Bobo doll where children watched adults hitting a Bobo doll. And when they saw adults hitting a Bobo doll, when they were left alone with this Bobo doll, they too hit the Bobo doll. So children learn by watching. And if they see people, adults around them, lying or being dishonest and not getting punished for it, they will learn to be lie and be dishonest as well. And it's not just the parents or the adults around them. It's also media. If you see individuals tweeting lies or lying in the media and not being called out for it, well, kids are going to learn that that's something you can get away with. So I think it's up to all of us, not just parents of children, but all of us to go, if there are people lying or doing dishonest things, you got to call them out for it. Otherwise, young, impressionable minds can learn that you can just get away by doing that. So, hey, let's do it as well. So absolutely, as far as children go, we have to watch for events of dishonesty and do something about it, and quickly. I think that was another point in there, too. You can't wait. A big part about conditioning is the time between a behavior and whether reward or punishment is delivered has to be very short. And the shorter that delay, the more likely the child or the individual is going to learn what the right behavior is.
Regan Gurung is with us right now, psychology professor from the University of Wisconsin-Green Bay, talking about new research that shows the more that we lie, the easier it gets to do it. And we'll take another phone call now. We've got Randy with us in Madison. Randy, hi.
Hey, good afternoon. I hope I have the right name here, but I recall reading the philosopher Cecilia Bach, who specialized in writing about lying. And And I remember that she used to cite studies that said, we all lie all the time. I mean, literally every few minutes. And if that's the case, how come we're not all expert liars?
Randy, thank you for that question. And I guess there's more of those shades of gray there, Regan. I mean, is there something to that idea that we do lie, or is there sort of more of a line in the sand than that?
Well, I think the, you know, the shades of gray is a good point, and it's the bigger point is, you know, when is actually something a lie? You know, when we talk about, you know, earlier on, you mentioned the white lies versus the other lies. Well, it's a matter of perspective. You know, you may think something is small, you may think something is a white lie, but that's not exactly how it may be perceived to somebody else, especially the person that you may be lying to. And I think that's a really big issue in dishonesty and lying, is this notion of empathy and sympathy. We now know that it's not just moral development, but it's also there are also moral emotions. And two of the most important are empathy and sympathy. And when you empathize, when you put yourself into the place of somebody else, when you try and feel what they're feeling, or when you feel for that person, the moment those two emotions are activated, dishonesty actually goes down. So I think very often this notion about shades and, you know, white lies, it's the moment you start empathizing, what you may have thought is not a big deal may actually be quite a big deal.
So is that a lesson we can take away here, Regan, from this research? How should we be thinking about our own personal morality and honesty based on this research that shows it gets easier to lie the more we do it?
Yeah, I think for me the big take-home message, and this was a really interesting article, because not only did it have a you know, put a good number of people into this fMRI machine. I mean, I've seen studies that are, you know, used to be 5 and 10, but this had 55 people in there. It's a pretty decent sample for an fMRI machine. But it really shows you that our physiological response is important. So the take-home message is, whenever you're in a situation, you know, be open to your physiology. Be open to how you feel, both physiologically and feeling-wise. And that last point that I mentioned is really key, especially if it is something to do with somebody else. Put yourself in their shoes and ask yourself, how would they feel if you did this or said this? And I think that would make your whole perspective on morality and lying very different than if you just had a self-centered focus.
We'll leave it there for now. Regan, always good to talk to you.
Thanks. Thank you, Rob.
We've been talking to Regan Gurung. He's the Ben J. and Joyce Rosenberg Professor of Human Development and Psychology at the University of Wisconsin, Green Bay. He joined us from our WPR studios there in Green Bay. We've been talking about new research that shows that it gets physically easier over time to lie the more we do it. You can read, by the way, Regan wrote a blog post about this topic. We've got a link to that over on the Central Time Facebook page. You can find out more about that original research, and you can share his blog post while you're there. Again, that's Regan Gruung, and we've got a link to that over at the Central Time Facebook page.
NPR is reporting today on some research that could really change some lives. A mechanical engineer at the University of California, Berkeley, set out to solve the mystery of why shoelaces come untied and, maybe more importantly, what we can do to prevent it.
The research, published in the Proceedings of the Royal Society, included lots of walking and then slow-motion imaging of the way shoelaces behave while we're walking. The verdict, the impact of each step on the ground, loosens that knot, it wiggles it loose. Then the back and forth motion of the end of the shoestring starts pulling the laces out of that loosened knot.
And so that's the bad news, or at least the information. But there's a solution. The researchers say we can tie our shoes differently. Kind of hard to describe on the radio. They suggest basically when you wrap around the bow, go the opposite way around the loop.
Yeah, I have trouble visualizing this. And there was a visual aid in the NPR reporting on it. And it was like, you know,
it was a
IKEA
confusing
diagram on steroids. Kind of. It didn't help me.
I mean, basically they're saying tie a better knot.
Right.
And I have such a knot. And I'm here to attest to you on the radio, in front of the world, that it has changed my life.
Yeah, you've evangelized on this knot to me, because my shoes come untied all the time. I'm clearly tying
right,
the weak knot. And you offered years ago, actually, to teach me this knot.
And you refused.
Yeah.
And what's happened?
I continue to suffer for my own stubbornness. There's a moral lesson in there somewhere.
It's worth it. Figure out how to tie the stronger knot and go and enjoy the rest of your life.
This is Central Time.